This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips. Mickey Huff will be back next week. Ann Garrison with KPFA Weekend News is here as a co-host for this show. Today we discuss the politics of genocide and the 20th anniversary of the tragic mass killings in Rwanda in 1994. Our first guest is Robin Philpott, a Montreal author of the new book Rwanda and the New Scramble for Africa. Our second guest is Ed Herman, professor emeritus of Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and co-author of the Monthly Review Press book, The Politics of Genocide. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips. Ann Garrison with KPFA Weekend News is here as our co-host for this show. Today we discuss the politics of genocide and the 20th anniversary of the tragic mass killings in Rwanda. This past week, I read two books, one, The Politics of Genocide by Ed Herman and David Peterson, and then I also read Rwanda, The New Scramble for Africa, From Tragedy to Useful Imperial Fiction with Robin Philpott. Both these books have a very similar historical take on what happened in Rwanda 20 years ago that is very different from what the State Department and what we're kind of hearing here in the United States. Here to introduce Robin Philpott is Ann Garrison.
Thank you. Robin Philpott is a graduate in literature and history from the University of Toronto. After working in Africa, he established himself in Quebec in 1974. In 1999, he became director of communications for the Saint-Jean-Baptiste Society in Montreal in support of Quebec's independence. He founded publishing company Baraka Books in 2009 and authored the book Rwanda and the New Scramble for Africa, From Tragedy to Useful Imperial Fiction. Philpott's brother, Montreal lawyer John Philpott, has represented defendants accused of genocide and crimes against humanity at the trials conducted by the International Criminal Tribunal on Rwanda. Robin, could you tell us the main points of difference between the story we've all been told for the past 20 years and what really happened in Rwanda?
The problem with the way people tell that story is that they concentrate on a very short period and they attribute a description to it which is basically counter to reality and basically eliminates the heart of the story. And I'll try and do it briefly. The Rwandan Patriotic Front, which now controls the government of Rwanda and is headed by Paul Kagame, was founded politically in 1988 in Washington. But the military part of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, which has become the RPA, the Rwandan Patriotic Army, consisted of the senior officers of the Ugandan Army, neighboring Uganda. And this organization, these regiments of the Ugandan army, left Kampala and invaded Rwanda on the 1st of October 1990, 3.5 years before the events occurred that everybody concentrates on. It was clearly a violation of international law, a crime against peace, an aggressive war from the Ugandan army, and with the approval and full knowledge of the United States. They conducted a very destructive and killing war in northern Rwanda over the next 3 or 4 years. If we now talk about what the Rwandan army does in the Congo, it began in that period between the 1st of October 1990 and April 6, 1994. They obtained a stalemate. They occupied the north. They terrorized the population, forced hundreds of thousands of Rwandans in the northern part of the country to flee towards Kigali. And to a point that by 1994, there were 1.5 million refugees, young people with no work, camped around Kigali. Now, this part of the story is never told, never told. The United States and the U.K., and France sponsored a peace process, as they called it, and hammered out a peace agreement in August 1993. It was called the Arusha Accord. It was under that accord that you had an international force, a peacekeeping force, headed by the General Dallaire, a Canadian general. And that peace held, and it was a power-sharing agreement between the parties in Rwanda and the invading government, which was already a concession for many Rwandans. And that peace held until the 6th of April, 1994, when the plane carrying the president of Rwanda and the president of Burundi was shot down. At the very same time, and according to witnesses, the RPF resumed the war. In other words, they broke the peace agreement, the power-sharing peace agreement, and led a blitzkrieg on Kigali. The Rwandan army pleaded for a ceasefire so they could stop the killings that were going on. And the ceasefire was refused. They sent representatives, what was left of the government, sent representatives to Washington and to New York to get the UN to apply the Arusha Agreement, this power-sharing agreement, and they ran into a wall which was erected by the United States and the UK. And it was based on the U.S. approach and the U.K.'s approach that led Boutros Ghali to say the genocide in Rwanda is 100% U.S. responsibility. Because the United States and the U.K., who had been backing the RPF, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, and Kagame, from 1990 right through to 1994, wanted a decisive victory of Kagame so that they could have a dominant power in Central Africa. And their calculation was whatever the cost, and the cost was terrible. So when people are talking about those events right now, the official story, which you read in the New York Times, we hear in most of the media, we hear from the State Department, we hear from Bill Clinton, others, and Tony Blair, and just ignores all these very, very key events. And they've applied an interpretation as if one day the Hutus in Rwanda decided to kill the Tutsis. It is counter to reality, and the reason people can believe that kind of thing is, in my opinion, because of historical prejudice towards Africa. I hope that's clear.
Robin, I hear what you're saying is that there's a 3-year history going into this. I mean, there's a decades of history, but certainly the 3-year history from 1990 when Ugandan troops invaded Rwanda, occupied the northern sector, creating a refugee problem of several hundred thousand people, and that contributed, of course, to this whole issue. There was accords that were reached where there was a peace deal arranged just 6 months before all the mass killings, yet, and UN was present, yet as that accelerated, and after the assassination of the presidents of Rwanda and Burundi, there was mass uprisings. And there was killings on all sides. So that's the period where sort of like people who say there was a genocide, that's kind of where they start. And they say, well, there was a genocide and the Hutus were prepared to go out and massively kill the minority group, the Tutsis, in Rwanda, at least the part that was not occupied by the RPF. Is that essentially the history at this point?
Yeah. What you have to realize is that Rwanda, and this is a great historian, René Lemarchand, who taught at Florida University, said, you know, we have to remember that Rwanda, with Zanzibar, was the only country in Africa, and I think he meant Black Africa, that had a revolution in the 1960s when it became independent. It had a revolution. It changed its whole social order, whereas many other countries had what could have been revolutions decapitated or controlled. Rwanda changed the orders. The ruling Tutsi aristocracy lost power, and they created a republic. What was going on between 1990 and 1994 was a counter-revolution. And the Rwandan population, Hutus and Tutsis who remained there, saw what was going to happen. It was a return to the pre-1960s where you had a minority of basically feudal lords who could do anything. And they were extremely desperate. And you had this 3-year war. The Rwandan Patriotic Front had in 1993, 146 clandestine cells operating in Kigali alone. Now, that means family. That means a lot of families, and probably largely Tutsi families, had brothers, cousins, people they knew who had gone over, and they were saying, go and fight for the RPF. Now, when the president is killed and when you see that you're losing what you've accomplished over the last 30 years, anything can happen. I mean, the United States has had a civil war. You know that when people distrust their neighbors, anything can happen. And you had neighbors killing neighbors. Now, the official story says this was planned well in advance. The problem with those who defend that story is that the adjudicated facts tell us a different story. And after 19 years of trials at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, they have yet to find somebody guilty of planning to commit a genocide.
The definition of a genocide means that there's a planned attack. It's an ethnic purging of a region by another ethnic group, in all likelihood, mass killings. And what you're saying is that there was no planning to this. It was spontaneous that there was all these refugees that were Hutu being threatened by the army from Uganda and being attacked, and there was mass revolts, and they went to the closest people that were the same people, the Tutsis in their neighborhoods, and there was mass killing on both sides.
Yeah, I try to avoid reducing this to a question of Hutus and Tutsis. This is politics. They had it for a long time.
Exactly.
A genocide against Tutsis and moderate Hutus. Now, what does that mean? All that means is the people were being killed who were obviously members of a fifth column, who were pro-RPF. And it's important to remember that between 1990 and 1994, the United States had forced on this peace process, but had already chosen sides. And at the same time, the French had decided it was time to force free elections, because this was after the fall of the Soviet bloc, so we had to have free elections. And so here you had all these parties springing up, these new parties, and the United States organized meetings where the invading army would meet with the parties who were internal opposition parties. So you had a situation which was extremely explosive, built by this so-called peace process. And the important thing is that when the killing started, there were forces who could have put an end to it. That is the army, the gendarmes. They could have stopped this killing going on. But in order to do so, you had to have a ceasefire, because they could not fight a powerful, highly armed and sophisticated army, which was the RPF, and at the same time reestablish order in Rwanda. And as I said earlier, they ran into a wall in New York, and that wall was controlled by the U.S. and the U.K. And now it's coming out, it's becoming more and more evident, and people who were with the RPF have been saying, they said, we did not want the U.N. to send any forces in there because we would lose the initiative. But our official public discourse was that the international community abandoned us and even sent their representatives. They talk about it freely, to meet with people in Washington and New York to ensure that there was no international, multinational force. And the U.S. State Department documents show that there were strict instructions that Madeleine Albright, who was then U.S. ambassador to the U.N., said there should be no troops sent in there, and there should be no more resolutions about Rwanda. This is in a key period, April, May 1994.
We're speaking with Robin Philpott. He's the author of Rwanda and the New Scramble for Africa. And you're just saying that it was the U.S., Madame Albright, that really blocked any intervention by the U.N. at the peak time when the mass killings were really occurring. There's actually been apologies for that from President Clinton, certainly at some point. But speak briefly to the link between Paul Kagame and the U.S. How has that link manifested itself historically, and where did it come from?
What became the political part of the RPF was founded in Washington in 1988. It was under the auspices of a certain Roger Winter, who has left traces all through Central and Eastern, Northeastern Africa. And then the military component of the RPF was being trained in the United States. Paul Kagame, when the invasion took place, he was number two, but he was studying, he was training in Fort Leavenworth. And many of the leaders were trained under the U.S. military training program known as IMET. So these ties go way back. All during the period between 1990 and 1994, the Rwandan Patriotic Front was established at its headquarters in northern Rwanda, occupied territory, where they'd chased out the population. And the U.S. ambassador was in and out of there steadily, was always there. And one of the things I learned last week, I was on this Voice of America program, Straight Talk Africa, Herman Cohen was in charge of African affairs under George Bush Sr. And he said the day of the invasion, there was a reception at the United Nations where the president of Rwanda and the president of Uganda were there. And the president of Uganda, Museveni, said, they learned then that there was an invasion. He said, I'm very mad. I'm going to discipline them as soon as I got home. So Cohen said, of course, we didn't believe it because we knew from our satellite photos, this is the U.S. ambassador saying, we knew that Uganda had deployed a massive logistic support equipment on the Ugandan side of the Rwandan border. So this is something which was going on. The U.S. encouraged it and had a long-term strategy, as from what I can understand, of establishing a dominant power in Central Africa from which they could obtain full control of Eastern Congo, because Mobutu, who was then the president, was on his last legs.
Robin, you've already described a really radically different story. I just want to summarize because it's unfamiliar to most listeners. Instead of 100 days of slaughter in 1994, you described an invasion by a U.S.-backed and U.S.-trained army from Uganda, a war that went on from 1990 to 1994 and ended in this 100 days. Then there was also the invasion of the Congo by Uganda and Rwanda, the two U.S. allies, 2 years later in 1996, war and conflict that went on for 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the U.S. displaced France as the dominant power in the region. Is there any chance that this could have been coincidental?
Well, I went back to exactly hear what the U.S. policymakers were saying in the early 90s. During the Cold War, they had dictators and people that they had basically kept in power until the fall of the Soviet Union. And then they basically were saying, we've got to take over where France was the most important power in Central Africa and West Africa. And they described the countries. And so that was very much part of their strategy. When they opted to back Museveni and Kagame. In fact, I found a quote from a State Department man who was meeting a French journalist, a long-standing French journalist, and he said, France has got it all wrong. The strong man is no longer in Kinshasa, but in Kampala, which he meant was Mobutu's gone. Our strong men are going to be Rwanda and Uganda. So when they started that war in 1990, and it's a war of killing and destruction that began in 1990 and has not ended. It's 25 years of war and death in the Great Lakes region.
And many, many millions of lives.
Many
Robin,
millions
we're out of time for this segment, but we're going to keep you on the line, and we're going to have Ed Herman on the second half. And then both of you can be in conversation towards the end of the show. But up next, we have a short, validated news summary from Project Censored.
I'm Siwatu Wright of Project Censored, and today's validated news story focuses on the lack of public record of civilian deaths at the hands of law enforcement. Although the FBI tracks how many police officers die in the line of duty, it keeps no such record for how many civilians are killed by police each year. Recognizing a significant lack of public record regarding civilian deaths at the hands of law enforcement officers, D. Brian Burkhart, the editor of the Reno News and Review and a journalism instructor at the University of Nevada, decided to create a public database. Burkhart is quoted as saying, "In 2014, how can we not know how many people our government kills in our streets every year?" End quote. Because Mr. Burkhart found that searching for information regarding civilian deaths at the hands of police officers often lead to dead ends, he launched FatalEncounters.org. Bethania Palma Marcus from TruthOut.org reports in a March 2014 article that Fatal Encounters is a website that tracks and tallies when police officers take lives and invites the public to help build the database. Burkhart has compiled a full list of police agencies in the country to facilitate public record requests about fatal incidents. Fatal incidents like the ones involving Ayanna Jones and Eugene Mallory. Jones was a 7-year-old from Detroit, and Mallory was an 80-year-old from L.A. Both were innocent of any wrongdoing, and both were shot and killed in their homes by police raids. Jones in 2010, and Mallory in 2012. Marcus reports cases like Ayanna Jones' killing have prompted the American Civil Liberties Union to ask whether Detroit police really needed, and I quote, amped up military equipment routinely used in nighttime raids in Iraq and Afghanistan, when they crashed into Ayanna Jones' home and killed her, and whether or not the access to the tools and tactics of a combat theater unnecessarily encouraged more aggressive policing, end quote. The ACLU also has launched a broad study on the connection between police militarization and aggressive policy practices that result in casualties like Ayanna Jones and Eugene Mallory. While these militarized police tactics increases the likelihood of civilian deaths at the hands of police, Burkhart hopes his database can serve as a valuable resource in determining how fatal encounters with police officers can be avoided. Already, he's noted patterns in the data that could prove to be powerful tools. Aside from criminal behavior, Burkhart states, the biggest factors common to officer-involved shootings are mental illness, race, and gender. Men are far and away more likely to be killed by cops than women. In the absence of data, it's impossible to assess whether problematic patterns lie and thus address them. There's a lot of speculation based on observation and anecdotal evidence, but Burkhart thinks essential information will save lives in the future. He is quoted as saying, that's one of the reasons for making this database, so law enforcement can look and pinpoint the places with the best outcomes and create policies based on other agencies' best practices. If there was some way to look at what the best practices are, their practices could be modified, end quote. This underreported news story was researched by Sasha Gay Santiago at Indian River State College and evaluated by Professor Elliot Cohen as part of the Project Censored Validated Independent News Program. For more validated independent news stories, see projectcensored.org.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips. Ann Garrison with KPFA Weekend News is here as co-host for this show. Today we discuss the politics of genocide and the 20th anniversary of the tragic mass killings in Rwanda in 1994. Here's Ann to introduce our next guest.
Edward Herman received his Ph.D. in 1953 from the University of California, Berkeley, and is now a professor emeritus in finance at Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania and co-author with David Peterson of the monthly review press book, The Politics of Genocide. He is well known for developing the propaganda model of media criticism with Noam Chomsky in their 1988 book, Manufacturing Consent, The Political Economy of the Mass Media. Ed, could you summarize the argument in your book, The Politics of Genocide, about how the word genocide, and particularly the Rwandan genocide, have been politicized?
Well, the propaganda system uses words according to political affiliation. I mean, this is a commonplace. So a snarl word or an invidious word like terrorism, aggression, or genocide, it is used to designate enemies. So in the case of Bosnia, the Srebrenica massacre was a genocide, although there were only claimed 8,000 victims. But in Iraq, where the numbers killed under U.S. auspices in the sanctions of mass destruction and then the war must run about 2 million, the word genocide is not applied. It's applied in Srebrenica. And of course, so it's a question of political affiliation. As Robin was talking about, in Rwanda, the U.S. and Britain were closely associated with the RPF and its takeover of Rwanda. And
so therefore the word genocide was not going to be used to apply to the RPF itself, but the RPF's victims, perhaps. And that's what happened. In fact, the RPF was claiming that the Tutsi were victims of genocide long before 1994. But then as the war, as the situation approached a full war in 1994, they used the word genocide lavishly, and the Western media picked this up, and the Western politicians, except there was a subtle point here in that the United States didn't want to get involved, didn't want any aid and any ceasefires to be applied. So if the word genocide was applied too lavishly, they would, their hand would be forced. They'd have to intervene to try to stop the genocide. So the internal documents at the time show that U.S. officials were very reluctant to use genocide to apply to that case until they were sure the RPF had won in late July. Then they approved the use of the word genocide. So the word genocide was used by the RPF and its friends to justify what they were doing. And then after the fact, the United States could justify what it was going to do to aid to the RPF, the Kagame government, because it had saved the country from genocide. So it all worked out very nicely. But the word has been institutionalized in reference to Rwanda. The Tutsi were victims of a genocidal operation by the Hutu conspirators, and this is now the standard model. And of course, Kagame and the government there use it aggressively. It's actually an offensive weapon, so that anybody who questions anything Kagame does or did is a genocide denier. So it, and of course, the words like terrorism and aggression, as well as genocide, are used in the same way. They can be offensive weapons. They can keep people quiet by accusing them of this kind of apologetics for bad things.
Ed Herman, you're the author of The Politics of Genocide, and you're really explaining here how Paul Kagame was really a U.S. asset. The Uganda had invaded Rwanda, and part of that invasion was displacement, Robin had been clear, of hundreds of thousands of Hutu. And the genocide is claimed that a million people were killed, most of them Tutsis, and this was a deliberate planned massacre. What are the realities of those numbers, and to what extent were Hutus killed as well?
The reality of those numbers is that more Hutus were killed than Tutsi by a large margin. I mean, the usual claim is 800,000 or a million Tutsi and moderate Hutu. This is not sustainable. It's not based on any serious work that I've ever been able to locate. It's really a propaganda claim. But I think the best study ever made of this was made by Davenport and Stamm, who were two American academics who first worked for the ICTR, the Rwanda Tribunal, but they were coming out with the wrong explanations. So they were dropped, and they actually are forbidden to go to Rwanda. But they have an outfit called Genodynamics. I think they're at the University of Michigan. And they have done very intensive studies, which came to the conclusion that many, many more Hutus were killed than Tutsi. They based this to a large extent on the fact that the number of Tutsi in Rwanda in 1991, when the last, I think that was the last Rwanda census, was 600,000. And the groups I think it's called the Ibuki, is a Tutsi survivor group that's comprised of about 30 organizations. It claims that there are about 400,000 Tutsi who live in Rwanda now. So if there were 600,000 in 1991, and not much different from that in 1994, and 400,000 survived, the difference between those two numbers is 200,000. So if 800,000 were killed, or a million were killed, that means that 600 or 800,000 Hutu were killed. I think these are actually completely reasonable figures, and these are based on a census, or uncontested census, plus estimates that Davenport and Stamm made based on a lot of study. So their numbers, I think, are believable. It looks like a lot more Hutu than Tutsi were killed. And so the standard, when you read the newspapers and read the various propaganda system statements about 800,000 Tutsi and moderate Hutu killed, this, I think, has to be considered complete baloney. It's misrepresenting the Holocaust. If there was genocide in Rwanda, the genocide was of Hutu, which is completely plausible because the main military force at work that conquered the country very quickly was the Kagame army. So it all works out.
To summarize again, there's a war of aggression begins in October 1990, goes on to April 1994. Many Hutu people in the north of Rwanda are killed during that time, and by April 1994, the city of Kigali, the capital of Rwanda, is surrounded by about a million desperate refugees from the north. Then the Hutu president is shot down, flying home from a peace process, the peace accords that were signed in Arusha. No one has ever been charged or prosecuted or punished for that crime. Could you speak to that?
That's a very interesting and important fact. The wide consensus is that shooting down on that plane was the triggering factor in the mass killing that followed. But so whoever did it must have had some connection with the mass killing itself. And in fact, the evidence is that Kagame and his forces did shot the plane down. The tribunal actually investigated this subject back in 1996 and 97, and they had a man named Michael Hourigan, I think he was an Australian lawyer, who had a team that worked on the subject, and they concluded that the plane had been shot down by Kagame and his forces. So when that was brought to the prosecutor's attention in Louise Arbour, she appears to have consulted the American embassy. And when Hourigan visited her, he was told that the investigation was over. And he says she was very hostile. So it looks as if the tribunal was controlled by the United States, and it was going to cover up the actual responsibility for the triggering event. So the apology of the people who follow the party line on this subject have a very difficult time with that shoot down, because here is this Hourigan incident, the likelihood that it was shot down by the RPF itself, and the RPF being extremely ready. This is another important fact. According to a number of authorities, the RPF was in action within an hour of the shoot down. And they were really ready, and they made their moves, and the government was unprepared and disorganized and was in quick retreat. So the theory that the shoot down and thus the triggering event and the genocide was based on planning by the Hutu insiders is incompatible with that fact. The belief that Kagame shot the plane down and that it was all part of a plan that was the end product of his aggression that began in 1990, that looks extremely plausible.
So, Ed, as Kagame's forces, the Rwandan army, advanced and basically took over Rwanda, millions of Hutu fled to Zaire and other places. The war really continued after that. I mean, there were bombings of the refugee camps. There were invasions of these other countries by Kagame. How did that fit into the U.S. agenda overall?
Well, it fitted in perfectly. In fact, one theory, I think Robin Philpott addresses this in his book, that this was the United States displacing France and rating Central Africa and Africa in general more important, and so advancing into Africa through the victory, the support of Kagame and Museveni, and their move into the Congo in 1996 and thereafter was supported by the United States. Here you have, according to UN estimates, up to 2002, there may have been 3.5 million people killed in the Congo. Read this sentence from a UN panel of experts on the illegal exploitation of natural resources and other forms of wealth in the Congo. They say these deaths are a direct result of the occupation by Rwanda and Uganda. It's a direct statement that Kagame and Museveni were responsible for 3.5 million deaths in the Congo. Add that on to the killings of the RPF in Rwanda. You're talking about really big numbers. In fact, my belief is that Paul Kagame is the greatest mass killer living on the face of the earth today. And yet in the American propaganda system, you find him referred to, he's treated as a saint, as a man who saved Rwanda from the deadly peril. In fact, I would also argue that there was a genocide in Rwanda, but it was the genocide of Hutu, and it was organized by Kagame with U.S. support. And then the genocide was actually increased in scope and power, so they call it a double genocide. Paul Kagame with U.S. support.
That's an amazing thing, and certainly to call Kagame the Abraham Lincoln of Africa is a misstatement, if anything.
Isn't that that's
yeah,
amazing.
It's quite amazing, but it's a wonderful propaganda play. So Robin Philpott, I'd like to bring you back into the conversation here. Both of you have written about Rwanda, and certainly Ed has written more about how genocide is used as a political term, and genocides done by people we don't like are called that. And when genocide happens in Iraq or other places where U.S. has been involved, the word isn't used. So how do you deal with and how do you respond to those people? And this is a question for both of you that call you genocide deniers around Rwanda.
Well, you know, this business of genocide denier, basically they're trying to borrow from what happened in the Second World War and the Nazi genocide of Jews, which just does not hold water at all, but it shows the limited ability of people of people who are establishing this propaganda model to get beyond about two or three issues in the world. The Second World War is always something on which they will try and build a political campaign. The goal of calling people deniers is to exonerate Kagame and exonerate the United States. That's what the goal is. They just want to shut people up so that you can't question this official truth. The problem is that when you do have this magnitude of death and destruction, the first question that should be asked is, how did it happen? Why did it happen? They do not want the world to look and say, why did this happen? How can we prevent this from happening again? What they do is they want to do a lot of mea culpas and so on, but there's nobody trying to say now who's responsible and why this happened. Because once they start digging that way, the conclusions will inevitably be those that Ed and I have reached. The second point that I would like to just add is that the subtitle of my book is From Tragedy to Useful Imperial Fiction. Right now, they're using that official story to justify intervention all over the world and to maintain this image of the United States as the honest broker, the guy who's there to help you. And the way they've built this image, it's one thing I do want to point out, is that human rights organizations, in particular Human Rights Watch, have been working overtime providing, you would say, the interference for establishing what is being called humanitarian imperialism. And one of the cornerstones of that is an official story about Rwanda. As Ed has pointed out, you won't find them using genocide when they go and invade Libya. They will say the enemy's committing genocide, but when the fighting has stopped, the people who are responsible for mass killings is the United States.
I would add to that. I think that's a very good point. If the question is why, how do we answer these people? I think it's very wise to point out this larger context, that it's actually these operators like Paul Kagame and the United States are involved in a larger imperial project, and this is obscuring it. But I also believe in calling these people by their right names. As I say, Paul Kagame, the killings of Hutu were far greater than the killings of Tutsi, and the initiative all through that period was Kagame and the U.S. initiative. And then they went into the Congo and they killed millions. So I think it was very important to call these people the deniers. In the case of Rwanda, they're denying the proper locus. Call them misallocators of the genocide. And then apologists for genocide in the Congo, because they don't talk about the Congo much and killings in the Congo. They focus on Rwanda, where their man actually was the genocidist. So I believe in taking a more aggressive stance on who the genocidists were.
Robin and Ed both, we're almost out of time, but could you tell us what the two of you think should be said to those who, quote-unquote, call on the U.S. or NATO to stop the next Rwanda, given your understanding of what really happened?
In the case of Rwanda, the United States had sponsored this peace process, and they had commitments. What they didn't do, and they did it very knowingly, is they didn't respect their own commitments. They didn't honor their own commitments when they signed that agreement. That is, we're going to share power between these two forces, the Rwandan government and the RPF. They basically abandoned the people who they had forced to go into this peace agreement because they had another strategy, which was to this, what I would call mad dog, take over in Central Africa. So I think there's a lot of events going on. I mean, if you look at Libya, what they did in Libya, it's equal in terms of destruction, what NATO did. First of all, I think that to prevent another Rwanda, we have to stop using Rwanda as a reason to intervene.
I agree. I think the way to prevent further Rwandas is to point out what the motives are of the people who are engaging in so-called humanitarian intervention. The total hypocrisy. These people have no right whatsoever to intervene anywhere. They're so compromised, and their special interests are so great. So I think exposing what they really have done and are trying to do is really key.
Ed Herman, we're out of time, but thank you very much. We've been talking with Ed Herman, author of The Politics of Genocide, and Robin Philpott, author of Rwanda and a New Scramble for Africa. You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest, and Lucretia Burton at the controls. The Project Censored Show airs on over a dozen stations across the U.S. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. See you next time.